Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name is Craig Forces. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs, high above the Rideau River. And Stephanie, what are we talking about today?
We are back with Bob.
Bob
from Mordor.
Yeah, which is code for talking about C-59.
C-59, which is still in the Senate, and they're talking about it, I guess.
Yeah, so it's still in the Senate. It's being debated. So we're recording this on October 31st. And last time I checked the parliamentary website, it was still being debated on second reading, so prior to going to committee. But there are debates. And so for a while, it was just sitting there and nothing was happening. There are now senators who have been giving speeches. That seems to be going along its merry path. How many more speeches there will be before it goes to committee, I don't know. It seems to be taking a while.
Right. So basically, it's there. And what we are going to talk about today is we've done a number of scenarios that we've walked through. So in this particular case, we're going to basically look at part four of C-59, which deals with CSIS, right, and amendments to the CSIS Act. And we're going to focus on three specific kind of themes, being one being disruption, one being data sets, and one being immunity.
Yeah.
All with your favorite cast of characters. Someone's going to have to design us a Bob from Mordor. We don't have, maybe we could start to have like a Bob from Mordor action figure. Just, you know, with Instapots.
Right. So, and it has to look like an accountant.
It has to look like an accountant.
Yes. All right. So, that's a lot, right? And it's quite complex. So let's do our best to sort of unpack the different elements. Those are actually three quite discrete issues. So why don't we start with the one that moves the ball the least distance down the field? That is, it builds on an existing CSIS power, but grapples with an issue, sort of a late day arrival on, oh my God, this is a problem issue. And that is the new immunity provisions that are available to intelligence officers and their sources when they're engaged in a security intelligence investigation. It could also be an investigation for foreign intelligence. So we're talking about an intelligence investigation where you're collecting information, the information functions of the service, not its threat reduction powers, which is quite separate and distinct, and we need to be careful not to confuse those two.
Right. So it's not doing pointy end of the stick stuff. This is the sticks part of the stick stuff, it's part of its kind of design from day one, gather information about threats to the security of Canada and advise the government.
Yeah, exactly. So it's conventional CSIS mandate. You're an intelligence organization. You collect intelligence. So the issue here for a long time is you're out there, you're collecting intelligence. Let's say you're an intelligence officer, you're a source, obviously you're covert, and you're using false documents to establish your identity. Or to infiltrate the group, let's say it's a terrorist group that you're collecting intelligence on, you have to give them some money or some sort of thing. Well, you're violating the criminal code, right? So you're using false documents, which is a criminal code offense. If you're giving money to a terrorist entity, a terrorist group, even incidental amounts of money, even if you don't necessarily want them to engage in terrorist activity, it doesn't really matter for our terrorism financing offenses, you're violating the criminal code. And so the issue has been, are you immunized from prosecution? Now, the practical reality is that you may not be prosecuted because a prosecutor looking at this would not proceed with charges. But I think there would be some concern about not automatically having immunity and being exposed to the potential, certainly if you're a source. So if you're a source, you're already going to be asking for money often for purposes of performing that role as a source. And if you're told, oh, and by the way, there's at least a theoretical prospect you could go to jail, then you might say, well, I'm going to double the
amount of
money.
People love that. Yeah. People operating in dangerous situations.
So this is an issue,
that,
right? And it's been raised by CERC, at least in relation to some of the service's foreign operations. And we don't know what they were talking about there, but it was raised in the CERC report, I think, two or three CERC reports ago. And I think for a considerable period of time, the service has been relying on an old provision found in the CSIS Act, Section 20, which basically says that the service has the same immunities as do law enforcement officers in conducting their functions.
But that's not in law.
Yeah, well, the problem is that since the CSIS Act was enacted in 84, we know that the law enforcement officers don't per se have immunity because of this notion of police independence. They don't enjoy what's known as Crown immunity. It's an old case called Campbell from 1999. The Supreme Court said, no, you're police officers. You're separate from the Crown. You're distinct. You don't have Crown immunity. And so when you engage in some kind of sting involving the sale of drugs, you're committing a crime. After that, Parliament enacted what's known as 25.1 of the Criminal Code to set a procedure whereby through sort of authorizations from senior ranks, the police could get approval to sell drugs as part of their sting or operation in infiltrating an organized crime group or the like. And so they have statutory immunity. It was very controversial, by the way, the idea that the police would violate the law to enforce the law. But they had a different statutory arrangement that was put in place that was quite distinct and is confined to essentially police and police criminal investigations. It would not extend to CSIS. So the criminal code provisions do not extend to an intelligence investigation. And so CSIS is out there sort of dangling in the wind without any formal immunity when we would probably all agree that the good requires you to pay $5 to demonstrate your bona fides in infiltrating this terrorist group or to use a false identity paper or the like.
$5 is pretty cheap to join.
Yeah, well, so I'm being facetious here, right?
Yeah, I know, but
It could be significantly more. But the bottom line is sometimes you've got to do this sort of activity in order to perform your undercover activity.
Right. So you've provided a scenario here, and should I kind of expand on it? So my favorite cast of characters. So we're investigating Trent from Oshawa.
Yeah. So remember, for those of you who listened to our podcast on CSE and CSE's New Power, we had this dastardly plot with Bob from Mordor, who was funding or instigating a terrorist plot involving Instapots.
Instapots, yeah.
Although that was in Gondor, we're going to change the locale here. We're going to make the Instapot terrorist plot take place in Canada, and the vector of that plotting was Trent from Oshawa.
Yeah, he's a jerk. I know him. Went to high school. I'm sure he went to Eastdale. Anyways, so Trent is collaborating with Sally from Brantford. In order to investigate this plot, CSIS knows about Sally, and CSIS decides to send in an intelligence officer or an undercover or someone to befriend Sally. This is a way that they can find out about the plot. So to get to know Trent and Sally, the undercover officer, I feel like the IO should have a name.
Smiley.
Oh, Smiley. Okay. So the IO Smiley, that's well done, agrees to pay for the cost of paintballing expedition to be used in a training exercise for their dastardly terrorist plot. I'm not sure how paintballing and Instapots work, but who am I to judge?
Yeah, but of course, the Toronto 18, they were all over the paintballing, although their plot was, depending on which plot you're talking about, was beheading the prime minister or blowing up the peace tower.
I think they just liked paintballing. Yeah. But actually, that's a whole thing, though, but actually just trying to generate a esprit de corps among your group is actually kind of important. So whether or not it was actually useful or not is an interesting question. That's beside the point. We're paying for paintballing that apparently is a part of a plot. So the CSIS IO Smiley is now criminally culpable.
Yeah.
And at
terrorism financing.
Terrorism financing.
Right. So 83.03, everyone who directly or indirectly provides property or financial or other related services, knowing that they will be used in whole or part for the purpose of facilitating or carrying out any terrorist activity or for the purpose of benefiting any person who is facilitating or carrying out such an activity, is guilty of an indictable offense and is liable to imprisonment for a term of not less than 10 years. Tick off all the boxes. Smiley's done that.
CSIS IO Smiley is probably a level 8 IO who has no idea what he's getting into.
Well, and Smiley's presumably not carrying a driver's license.
In Toronto region,
he's probably got a fake driver's license, right? Yeah. So false documents, which is also a criminal code offense.
Right.
And so that's a bit of a problem, right? Now, again, this has always been a problem, at least since 1999, at least in principle, because they do not enjoy any kind of immunity since this Campbell and Schroes case established the police don't. And so at issue here is whether there has to be a corrective. And C-59, I think probably quite properly concluded, yes, we need a corrective. We need to insulate from criminal culpability a person who's performing the sort of functions that Smiley is here. Of course, the problem is you're now authorizing CSIS to breach the law for purposes of collecting intelligence. And so you need safeguards. And we're back to our common conversation on this podcast.
Right.
I understand the policy justification. What are the checks and balances?
Right.
And so C-59's got quite a few checks and balances. And for aficionados of charts, I posted my updated flowchart of how these powers in C-59 will operate on my blog, nationalsecuritylaw.ca. And it's a pretty complicated process, but it's one that's quite sensible. It builds on that criminal code provision 25.1 that's available for the police. Although here, I think the safeguards are even more pronounced, in part because with CSIS, it's unlikely it's ever going to come out. Whereas the police, the purpose
as part of the criminal prosecution,
right? The fact that you're running a sting is the sort of thing that's going to come out. Whereas with CSIS, it shouldn't ever come out, at least with intelligence.
Unless something's gone terribly wrong, right?
So there's an approval process that implicates, by the way, both the minister and the intelligence commissioner, describing the class of things that the service is allowed to do in terms of breaching law. And then inside the service, there's a check and balance system of internal approvals. But most importantly, there's an outer limit. And so there's an outer limit of things that can never be approved that you cannot do, even with this authorization scheme. And so it's the same list as will exist for threat disruption, things you can never do is threat disruption after C-59. And so causing bodily harm, willfully obstructing or defeating the course of justice, violating the sexual integrity of a person, subjecting an individual to torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, detaining an individual, causing loss or any serious damage to any property if doing so would endanger the safety of an individual. So those are no-go areas. And so it's not like you could ever get approval to beat up someone.
Okay.
Right? That's not possible under the arrangement. And so looking at the checks and balances that exist in the system and given the policy objectives, I think it's a reasonable compromise. Now, of course, reasonable compromise requires you need a watcher.
Yes.
And this sort of activity should be closely scrutinized by the successor of CSIRC, that is the National Security,
National Security
and Intelligence Review Agency.
Yeah.
And so this will be an important emphasis, I think, for them going forward, assuming that they're stood up properly and have proper resourcing.
Okay.
All right, so that's our first issue.
So, and again, just to make it clear for our audiences, this is about the ability to conduct investigations.
Intelligence investigations,
yeah. Not to disrupt them.
Yeah, this disruption is governed by a separate regime, which we're going to talk about now.
Right, okay. So I'm sure there's a bunch of level 8 IOs out there that are very happy to hear that they're going to be legally protected. That's just a guess.
Yeah, and probably sources as well.
Right.
So our scenario here is a little bit more complex for disruption. So the problem with disruption, technically called threat reduction. So this was a power introduced by C-51.
Right.
Very controversial because it moved the service from strictly an intelligence or information gathering entity to one that can actually do things to people in the real world.
Much more pointy, sharpening the pointy end of the stick.
And we've talked about past, this is, I didn't object to the idea in principle. It was the way it was articulated in C-51 that raised all sorts of concerns. For one thing,
passing a warrant that says you're allowed to violate the charter is just not going to
happen.
Yes,
so it absolutely was the structure for approvals. And so let me start actually back up a second. The outer limits were too unconstrained. So the outer limits for the service in terms of things they were allowed to do as part of threat reduction. So they could take any reasonable measure that was proportional to the threats to the security of Canada. And so that would not just be terrorism, right? That would be everything that's in that threat to the security of Canada, espionage, sabotage, foreign influenced activities, subversion. They could take reasonable measures to minimize that threat, measures as not defined. Okay. And so they can do anything that's proportional, so long as, and these were the outer limits that were baked in, so long as it wasn't bodily harm, obstruction of justice, or violation of sexual integrity. Only those three limits.
Yeah.
Right. So detention was on the table.
Yeah.
And with detention, things like renditions on the table. Mm-hmm. And the Tories at the time said that they cleaned that up by saying that nothing in the act would purport to give the service the powers of a law enforcement agency. Yeah, but you can detain for all sorts of reasons short of criminal arrest, right?
Yes.
So that was a meaningless addendum at the 11th hour to C-51. So detention was clearly still on the table. And there was also the prospect that in performing threat reduction, the service could violate any Canadian law or, said the act, the charter, so long as authorized by a federal court warrant. And I'm not going to rehearse why that's a problem because we've talked about it at length last year. But the idea that you could get a warrant from the federal court in secret proceedings, never revealed, not subject to appeal, at least not easily subject to appeal, where only one side was present, that is the government side, and that court could then bless a violation of any charter right, not a limitation on that charter right, but an outright breach of that charter right, was absolutely anathema to the way we structure our Constitution. And it's not like a search warrant. We've had this conversation. It's not like an arrest warrant, because search warrants talk about reasonable searches and seizures, and the warrant is what makes the search and seizure reasonable. It makes it compliant with Section 8 of the Charter. It's not authorizing a breach of Section 8, as opposed to, say, in principle, a judge signing off on violating someone's right to vote in an election,
mm-hmm.
right, which is in principle available, so long as a service regarded as proportional and convinced a judge of that. More than that, we don't know. We had no notice as to what charter rights might be on the table because Parliament didn't bother to prescribe a list of what sort of things would be appropriate measures and appropriate constraints or limitations on the charter or breaches of the charter or violations of Canadian law. It was an open invitation for the service to go to a judge and negotiate what it was the service was going to do in secret. We never know. Bad things would start happening to people. There wouldn't necessarily be any disclosure.
Until there was the inevitable Royal Inquiry
right.
and Commission.
So the prospect that that could be defended as what's known as a Section 1 justification, a reasonable limitation prescribed by law on rights in the Charter. Nothing's prescribed by law on this. It's an open invitation to breach any charter right. I have no notice. Parliament hasn't actually given me any notice as to what sort of rights are on the table here. It's a carte blanche.
And so, yeah, and I mean, like, look, I mean, this often sounds like two profs just wringing their hands over like, abstract questions. But from a very practical view, the reason that this is problematic is that intelligence services like clear lines, believe it or not. They, and I think I've said this on the podcast before, it's just they like clear lines. They want to know what they can and cannot do, because the worst case scenario for them is that they think that they can do something. They then find out they can't and an entire case falls apart or something terrible happens. And because you know what? CSIS directors don't like giving big press conferences. Yeah. They don't like having to go up in front of court.
This is an uncertainty engine.
Yeah.
This is an uncertainty engine. And,
it's a bad
and the service
thing.
Has two risks with the current architecture. First risk, there's a public interest challenge.
Yeah.
And if that public interest challenge goes up, and it's a pretty good public interest challenge, right? Because how else does anyone challenge this regime? Because you can't get into the federal court on this because you're not the service, right? And so the public interest challenge could go up and say this is unconstitutional. And there's also the prospect the service would go to the federal court, and the federal court would take one look at this and say, this is not the sort of architecture we feel comfortable with, and we think it's unconstitutional.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the day, this is a high-risk enterprise. And even if the federal court signed off on this, and as you suggest, down the pipe something happens and it's revealed, and there's the prospect of some kind of scandal or collateral challenge coming up in a criminal case. So this is an unworkable system, but motivated, it seems to be, by a good policy objective. And the policy objective is, should the service be capable of intervening in some circumstances where it's best suited to intervene to minimize a risk?
Yes.
And so in the past, we've talked about a hypothetical where you're gathering intelligence and you discover in the course of gathering intelligence that the target has collected an explosive material, a fertilizer or something.
Right, that plots far more along than
can you break and enter for the purposes of swapping out that chemical for an inert substance?
Right.
Well, prior to C51, you couldn't, right? That would be break and entry. That'd be violating the law. And so there are circumstances where the service will be best suited to intervene, and you know, maybe they could call the police and the police could get a Section 25.1 authorization to break the law. And now the police is involved, right? So then it becomes a complicated coordinating exercise between the police and the service, which raises intelligence to evidence issues, right? So there are circumstances where the service is best suited to act. I accept that. And so the fetters were too tight. Here, the fetters are relaxed after C51 to a point that they're largely meaningless in my view, right? And constitutionally inadequate. And so can you find that Goldilocks point in between the too hot, too cold, just right? And I think C-59 tries to do that. And it does that in two ways. It adds to that list of no-go areas. And so included very importantly is no torture,
yep.
No cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment, which arguably was already covered by no bodily harm. But there are forms of cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment that arguably could escape discipline by the prohibition on bodily harm.
Yep.
All right. So that's an important addition. No detention. That's a really important one, because most charter rights, at the end, the condition precedent for that breach is often detention. You can't do rendition without detention. It's pretty hard to do cruel and inhuman treatment without some sort of detention. Well, that is possible. But the bottom line
can
is...
Can I just also be honest here? CSIS doesn't actually have any detention facilities.
Well, that's it.
This
would you want the service, yeah, a covert intelligence agency, to engage in detention? Are they going to hold people in the basement over an Ogilvy Road? When we detain
There's
people...
There's a nice gym down there, so I'm pretty sure that would not be popular.
When we detain people, when the police do detain people, that detention is clothed in all sorts of rules about how you can detain, where you can detain, how long you can detain. There's judicial supervision of the detention. Here, we'd be talking about the judge signing off and saying, detention fine, presumably imposing some sort of conditions if they're halfway adequate in terms of the way they issued the warrant. But thereafter, there's no built-in statutory safeguards in the nature of that detention. And what about if it was international and we're talking about a non-Canadian who didn't have charter rights? You wouldn't even need to go to a judge.
Mm.
Right, because the requirement to go to the judge only exists if you're breaching Canadian law or violating the charter. And since most Canadian law is territorial in scope and the charter is territorial in scope, if you're overseas, there'd be a good argument that you'd never have to go to a judge to get that blessing. So you could run your detention centers overseas without any judicial supervision. That's a problem. So superimposing a requirement that you don't do detention is both good from an ethical perspective. It's good from a logistical and operational perspective, because this is not a game we'd be equipped to get into with our covert services. And it's good from a legal rule of law perspective as well. All good, because there are other opportunities and ways you can detain people, not least preventive detention by the police, which is still in the books and has never been used.
Right.
And yes, it's being tinkered with in C-59, but in those minor ways, and to the extent that people are getting exercised about it, I think they exaggerate. Police do detention, the service does not. and nor should it in terms of threat reduction. And there's also a misunderstanding about threat reduction that it's some kind of emergency power. It's not an emergency power.
No, just because it needs a warrant doesn't make it an emergency
power. Yeah, so you got to, it's not like, people have this image that, in a dire circumstance, the service will be running red lights and breaking and entering in some kind of emergency situation. If you're running a red light, you're violating the law of Canada. And so you need to get a warrant in principle, and that's not an emergency. Even if you can do expedited warrants, it's not that expedited. So this is a premeditated power, not an emergency power. It always has been a premeditated power. It was structured as such in C-51. C-59 doesn't change that. So the scenario we want to walk through here is actually a real scenario. And it's based on the Jabara case.
Yeah. And do you want me to say Trent or do you want me to say Jabara?
Well, we're going to dress it up in two characters. We're going to involve Trent from Oshawa again, and we're also going to bring in Bob from Mordor just to illustrate how things can work or not work very well. But just the overview of the Jabara case. So the Jabara, Mr. Jabara is a nasty figure, right? So he was implicated in...
He was an admitted Al-Qaeda member.
Right.
And he was the leader of a terrorist cell that planned to bomb the American and Israeli embassies in Singapore and Manila. And, you know, it would have been a terrible attack. But basically the plan got thwarted and... He got out of the country, but he was apprehended in another country.
He's apprehended in Oman. He's Canadian.
Yeah. Right. And on short notice, the service traveled to Oman and unexpectedly found themselves having to basically arrange for Jabara to go back to Canada because Omanis didn't want him.
They didn't want him.
So basically...
Cesus paid for his ticket.
Right.
And then thereafter, there was, an interview process, one might say. Mr.
An interview process, one might say.
Yes.
Well, I'm sure they're like, so what was up with the terrorism
yes.
while we're on this long flight?
The issue, though, is whether the interview process on the ground in Canada thereafter was a detention.
Oh, right.
And Justice Laforet, who was brought in by CERC to assess this case, concluded that was, in fact, a detention. Mr. Jabara then agreed to cooperate, and CSIS took him across the border. And he was surrendered to U.S. authorities, not an extradition post. He cooperated for a while with U.S. authorities, but that cooperation fell down, and now he's in jail for life in the U.S. Now, he couldn't have actually been prosecuted in Canada at the time, by the way, because his conduct predated the offenses, the post-9/11 terrorism offenses, and you can't retroactively apply those terrorism offenses.
Right, because this was in the 90s.
His conduct was actually pre-December 2001. Late 90s, early 2000s.
Before Bill C-36 had been passed in 2001.
Which came into force, I believe, in December of 2001.
Right.
So what happened? Well, CERC gets a hold of this, brings in former Supreme Court Justice Laforet, and concludes that, I'll just summarize here, neither CSIS nor the police had any right to detain Jabara. Based on these and other circumstances, the CERC concluded that Jabara was arbitrarily detained by CSIS in violation of Section 9 of the Charter. Because he was detained, his right to silence as protected by Section 7 and 11C was violated, as was his right to counsel under Section 10. Further, his right to remain in Canada as protected by Section 6 of the Charter, mobility rights, was breached. So that's a whole bunch of charter breaches.
Yeah, it's not great.
It's not great, right? So... could the service now do that with threat reduction powers?
Well, if it's a detention, no.
Right now it can.
Right now it can. Under C-51, but other than that, it couldn't. So I'm wondering, what would you do in that case? Just get the RCMP to do it?
Yeah, well, so you should have had the RCMP do it.
Yeah.
Now you would have the RCMP do it.
That's the thing that I keep thinking. Like, where's
the RCMP? The question as to whether you could be charged with anything.
Right.
Right. And so if he couldn't be charged with anything, it's not a police matter. I don't know if that would have been true, incidentally. I'd have to look at the issues about... because we did have terrorism crimes before 9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those classic...
presumably planning to commit a murder, which effectively what this
is. So there's a territoriality issue here.
Yeah.
And so you'd have to find a Canadian nexus. Could you use crimes against humanity or war crimes? Right. Certainly crimes against humanity might be a player. And we actually declared, by the way, Canada took the view that the 9/11 attacks were a crime against humanity.
Right.
So bottom line is that there was... I'm not entirely persuaded there wasn't some wiggle room on the criminal side.
Yeah.
But now if this were to happen, there would be substantial prospect of criminal prosecution. You'd send the Mounties, right? So we're not taking away by saying CSIS can't detain and do a repeat of Jabara. We wouldn't be taking away from the prospect.
We're in an entirely different legal environment.
We're in a different legal environment, right? So so imagine that the scenario is Trent from Oshawa and now he's overseas and he's been detained by Oman in the connection with this Instapot
plot
that we keep talking about.
Right.
Right. In principle, could CSIS do a repeat of Jabara? Under C-51.
Under C-51, yes.
Yes, if they got a warrant.
Yeah.
And the warrant could exonerate all these violations of the charter.
Yeah.
Would a court ever be persuaded to do that? The federal court, I just don't see it, right? I don't see the federal court
Justice
doing this.
Given Noel's decisions, I'm going to say yeah. a big old
But in
no,
principle, but... you know, you could go to court and seek such a warrant to violate all these charter rights.
Yeah.
And so you'd be violating a whole bunch of charter rights where there's never been a pre-authorization to breach them by warrant ever before.
Right.
And so that would be really troublesome. And if it wasn't this fellow from Oshawa, Trent from Oshawa, that we were talking about, but instead it was Bob from Mordor, a non-Canadian in Oman, would you even have to go to the federal court?
Can I ask a question, though? Like, would this be considered disruption? Because the plot had already been disrupted. But if you believed that Jabbar was coming back for the purpose of engaging
yeah, in so in our scenario, where it's the Instapot plot is
plot
still
that he's
afoot,
involved in.
Right?
Okay,
so
right.
That's, it is a measure to mitigate a risk to the threats to the security of Canada.
And Instapots.
And so if it was Bob from Mordor who's in Oman, and you weren't necessarily bringing him back to Canada, let's say you were taking him directly to the United States, would you even need to get a warrant? Does Bob from Mordor in Oman, who has no connection to Canada and is not a Canadian citizen, have charter rights? No.
Right.
Not obviously, unless to do so
Bob
would breach Canada's international obligations. Although the federal court has said that at issue is whether the victim overseas is a Canadian citizen and deciding whether to extend the charter extraterritorially. And Bob from Mordor is not a Canadian citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So you would not necessarily need to even be supervised by the federal court in this sort of Jabbar situation with a non-Canadian who is being rendered without any kind of transit through Canada. And so, again, I think that's a problem, both ethically and operationally. I think that's a huge problem. And so what does C-59 do? C-59 says no detention.
Yeah.
And so it would close the door to any repeat of a Jabbar-like scenario, even assuming you could find, you know, with Trent, a judge who was willing to sign off. And but I think that's an important addition.
But in that situation, so you have Trent, who's in Oman, as a part of the Instapot plot.
Right. Canadian citizen.
And we know he's going to come back to Canada, or we think he's going to come back to Canada.
Or he's just the guy at the end of the phone, right?
Or he's the guy at the end of the phone. We don't know. So the Omanis call up CSIS. CSIS is, in this scenario, I think, under C-51, it could absolutely get a warrant to detain. Under C-59... they would probably have to go to the RCMP.
Yeah, they'd go to the police and say, you need to handle this because you're the detaining entity.
Right.
We're confining detention to the police who presumably know how to do detentions properly.
Right.
Without scuttling future criminal prosecutions. Because, you know, imagine the service goes and they detain and the service has permission to violate all these charter rights and Mr. Trent from Oshawa says things in the course of that detention by CSIS that's inculpatory.
You couldn't use any of it.
No. I mean, the fact that the service is exonerated from its charter breach just doesn't mean that you can then turn around and use the fruit of those charter breaches in a trial, because the court will say, look, you may be exonerated, but I'm still in control of a fair trial. And the fair trial rights of Mr. Trent have been violated by the fact that you use this circuitous route to gather evidence against him. So the real risk is that the service would scuttle any future prosecution, and we'd end up with people who are unprosecutable because of this poison chalice of a threat reduction operation, right? And so clean it up and keep it in the hands of the police, the detention side of things.
Yeah. Plus, again, CSIS does not have great or any detention facilities. Well, again, I literally don't know where you
would
put these people.
Do you want to train up a parallel detention capacity in the service? And do you want to go down the route of the CIA and its dark
side? You can't even get good coffee at CSIS. Yeah. I don't want them doing detention facilities.
So the other issue here is, you know, so that resolves the detention. And once you take detention off the table, a lot of charter right breaches fall away.
Right. So, but I think, look, the bottom line here is that C-59 says what you can and can't do, what requires a warrant. It's far more restrictive.
Yeah.
And the good news for CSIS here, I think, is that, okay, yes, there's less things that you can do, but you know the things you can do, and you know how to do them. And you can put the procedures in place, which gives you that certainty that you can go ahead and do what you need to do and make the plans that you need without actually things going terribly wrong.
Yeah, and you create constitutional certainty in another way, right? So right now under C-51, it's an open list. Whatever charter breaches you think are proportional that you invent CSIS and convince a judge to sign off on, that's good. That's not the scheme under C-59. Under C-59, there's a requirement, yes, if there's a prospect a charter right would be limited, that you have to seek that warrant. But then the judge is only competent to issue warrant for a closed list of activities. And so interfering with communications, which could plausibly raise freedom of expression issues under Section 2 of the Charter, that's on the list. Interfering with movement of an individual, which could raise Section 6 mobility rights issues, that's on the list. The difference is you and I and the Canadian public and Parliament and everyone else can look at that closed list and we can say, we can now understand what it is that the service is being empowered to do by the legislature. This is being prescribed by law in an open piece of legislation, and we can anticipate the sort of charter issues that are at play. And there's no way, for example, I can see on that list any prospect of interfering with someone's right to vote or to run as a candidate, for instance, which is theoretically possible now under C-51, right? So we've reduced the zone of constitutional uncertainty, and now we've prescribed by law the list of things that the service will be entitled to do if they persuade a judge that it's proportional. That puts it in a much more conventional space constitutionally in terms of what we call a Section 1 justification. It's still novel, and people like Michael Nesbitt will say that it's still doubtful, but it's a lot closer, it seems to me, than the carte blanche in C-51. And I'm actually quite content with it because I don't know what else you would do.
Right, but I would just observe that Trent from Oshawa's political campaign is not off to a great start.
Yeah. Well, my original scenario for this discussion was an electoral one, but I got to the point where it was piling sort of improbable upon unlikely, and so I decided to go with this Jabera-like scenario,
Bob from Mordor is totally likely.
Okay. Yeah. But Jabera did happen, right? Jabera did happen.
Okay, so finally, why don't we move on to data sets?
Right.
Okay,
so
right.
If we haven't lost everyone,
I know.
At this point. Data sets. So just to explain data sets.
Yes.
So data sets are those amalgamations of data that the service will now be allowed to accumulate that it can't currently accumulate. Why? Because it's data that's not strictly necessary for security intelligence purposes, right? So right now, if you're going to retain data as part of an investigation, that retention must be strictly necessary for that investigation for security intelligence, or at least necessary for foreign intelligence. So and that was the outcome of the Justice Noel decision with ODAC.
You can't,
in other words, be an amalgam of data that you can fish in, an ocean of data in which you can fish in order to detect a plot. You can only keep the data that's tied to an existing investigation.
Yeah.
And so that limits what you can do as an intelligence service. You can investigate things you know about, but you can't find the things that you don't.
Yes, which is...
which is a problem.
Problem, because right. It's not great.
Yeah. So it's a chicken and egg problem. I describe it as a chicken and egg problem, right? So your investigation has to come first before you can keep the data. But what if you need the data to trigger the investigation? Because a Section 12 investigation for security intelligence purposes, you need to have reasonable grounds to suspect a threat to the security of Canada. And that means there's got to be a possibility. And that possibility has to be established by information. There has to be enough credible information. So it's a chicken and egg. How do you get the credible information to start the investigation when you can't get the information unless you got the investigation? So what do? You create?
A data set regime.
Right.
Right.
And so we have a scenario here.
CSIS wants to collect a database of all Canadian passports reported stolen in the last year. It would want to be able to cross-check this data set against other data sets, including manifests of all passengers on flights from Canada to Turkey. Can it do this?
Well, would they want to do that? Why might they want to do that?
Well, someone's traveling on a stolen passport.
And why
for
Turkey?
The purposes of joining the Islamic State.
Right.
Right, because a lot of people would fly to Turkey, or I'd actually expand it out to Europe.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people did broken travel.
Sure. So you're gonna have big data sets, right?
Yeah.
So you're creating an ocean. You're creating an ocean of data in which you as a service would want to fish.
But you would because you want to be able to cross-check.
Right, cross-check.
Right. Yeah.
So could you do this right now?
I'm guessing no, because that if that ocean is there, then Justice Noel is like, uh-uh. But if...
Yeah, and CERC actually in the most recent report said, CSIS, you got data sets you're not actually allowed to collect.
But we pointed out, I think, pretty
fair that...
You're technically
in non-compliance with the law until C-59 is changed.
Yeah, but right. I think we're hoping that will change soon. Because this strikes me as a very necessary thing that you would... You know, I think Canadians would be appalled if they felt that you couldn't actually keep a list of stolen passports.
Right.
I mean, that to me is like
so
something
Passport
that,
Canada can.
Yes.
Passport Canada can, but in Passport Canada's possession. And so under the famous Security of Canada Information Now Disclosure Act after C-59.
Not yet, but soon, yeah.
Currently the Sharing Act, Passport Canada in principle could share stolen passport data with the service. But the service would have to show its lawful authority. And to do so, it would have to have already started an investigation.
Yeah, right? And which it wouldn't necessarily be able to start.
Has Trent from Oshawa reported a stolen passport? Passport Canada, you are authorized to tell us under the SCIDA, and technically also under the Privacy Act, I'd say.
Right.
And Passport Canada could cough up that piece of information. But what if instead the service had a more open textured investigation? All the people we fear might be foreign fighters. And to get that information about their passport information, they'd have to ask about each one in Passport Canada's possession. And of course, then they've now revealed to Passport Canada everyone they suspect of being a foreign fighter.
Well, yeah, because I was going to say, actually, I think the bigger problem is if you have people who have reported a stolen passport that have subsequently gone to Turkey, you wouldn't be looking for Trent from Oshawa. You'd be looking for the people on the stolen passports that are engaged in suspicious travel,
right?
Which, in which case you wouldn't know,
yeah,
because you're not looking at all those other people. You're looking at Trent.
The knowable unknowables.
Yes.
Right.
Wait.
So the problem here is right now you can't deal with the knowable unknowables. You,
yes,
know that there's something there, but, yeah, you don't know what it is you don't know.
Right.
I'm sort of starting to sound like Rumsfeld here.
I'm going in circles, but you know, it wouldn't be the first time, probably.
Who was
last.
Right, by the way, in saying those kind of things. But the bottom line is that you cannot fish in a pool when the pool is in someone else's possession. And if you want to use a query, you've got to reveal that query to that other agency. And the other agency is going to turn around and say, well, what's your lawful authority? And you have to say, well, we don't really know because we haven't really started an investigation because we don't have reasonable grounds to suspect anything yet. But, you know, we're just trying to correlate data here in order to create that reasonable grounds to suspect so we can start an investigation. Chicken, right, and egg, chicken and egg, chicken and egg, and around we go. So what does C59 do?
So it allows the CSIS to create a data set if it has ministerial authorization. But I think as well, the information commissioner,
yeah,
also has to check some of these things out.
Yeah. So you can create data sets, but what it does is, remember this conversation, I think it's reasonable that the service be able to do this.
Yeah.
Next question. Is the power itself reasonable? I understand the policy objective. Is the power, is the statute itself reasonable? And I guess there's always a third question. Is it being used reasonably? Is the power itself reasonable? And a power like this, because we're talking about agencies that have substantial ability to mess with people's lives.
Yes.
And there's a serious privacy implication here because we're talking about accumulating data about people who are absolutely innocent and will never be embroiled in a security investigation because their data is part of the pond in which you're fishing.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about now a security service accumulating that data. Are there sufficient checks and balances? That's why the data set regime is complicated. We're seeing some people in the Senate saying, too complicated, too complicated. You need the complexity for both good policy reasons.
Yeah.
You build your law to accommodate not the most virtuous spy service you can imagine, but the most pernicious. That's what you need to do with national security law because there's not everyone is a philosopher king who works in security services and bad things happen, right? So you need checks and balances.
Philosopher kings tend to make bad spies.
Yeah, probably.
Although you did do quite a few philosophers.
So the issue is whether there are sufficient checks and balances. So data sets are divided into three classes. Data sets that are predominantly about Canadian information, data sets primarily about foreign information and so-called publicly available. I think the wrinkle is publicly available.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that in a second. With Canadian data sets, that's where you have most checks and balances. So approval by the minister and the intelligence commissioner of the class of data sets you're allowed to collect. And then an internal vetting to clean up certain privileged information to make sure it's not part of the data set. And during that initial cleanup, you're not allowed to query. Before you query, if you want to retain it, if you decide it's a useful data set, let's say it's your passport data set, you got to go to federal court and seek a retention order from the federal court. And the federal court can impose conditions on how you're going to query. Only then can you query, right, for useful information. So before you can fish, the game warden has to sign off on your lure. Just,
yes,
to run this hypothetical.
And that's what makes it okay under Section 8.
I think so, because Section 8 hasn't quite got there yet. Section 8 is mostly about protecting on the collection side, not the retention and use side. But Section 8 is going very quickly, it seems to me, you've got it, but we're also now going to police how you use it because there's so much data, we're awash in data, right? And so the idea that you can police privacy now simply as a gatekeeper on what you can collect, I think, is the proverbial horse has long since left the barn. Right. And so I think it does anticipate where Section 8 of the Charter is going. And I think it's actually a pretty good system, although a bit laborious. For foreign data sets, the person who has to sign off on the querying is the intelligence commissioner and not the federal court. With public data sets,
it's going to be
crickets. Right. So that's the problem. Right. So there are internal checks and balances and protocols, but there's not an external supervisor, not an external oversight regime. So everything then hinges on how you define publicly available data sets, because if you define it too broadly, that exception will swallow the benefit of the checks and balances with the Canadian data set and foreign data set systems. Now there's no definition. There's no definition of publicly available data set. And so
But I think the part of the reason for that
Is to avoid stale dating.
Is to avoid stale. You know, yeah. We've talked about this before. The fact is, the problem is, if we were doing this podcast 10 years ago, the idea that Facebook would be, well, maybe 2008, but Facebook was there. But like, you know, like 15 years ago, there was no Facebook, yeah, sure. Right? And gosh knows what, I founded a new social media service called Nextdoor. I don't even know what it is. So would you have, like, how would you have to define and list these
in a way that won't stale date?
Right.
So the issue really is, publicly available should not be defined so broadly as to sweep in information in which you have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Yes.
That should be routed through the Canadian dataset regime. The argument being that even though the actual collection of that Canadian data has not been pre-authorized by a judge in every instance, the law is reasonable, it's being applied reasonably, and the retention and searching is authorized by a judge, and therefore it can be defensible under a Section 8.
Is that what's there now?
Yes. Right. So as long as you're steering, it seems to me, information in which a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy and therefore triggers Section 8 through the Canadian dataset regime, then you're okay. As soon as you get into using Cambridge Analytica data and calling it publicly available because it was available for purchase on commercial basis, at least in principle on the market, and you can get it in some other way that's technically public in the sense that you didn't have to use your covert means and it wasn't some sort of proprietary information only in the possession of the government, as soon as you start talking about things like Cambridge Analytica possibly being publicly available, then you've now circumvented all the checks and balances. More than that, you now have in your possession information in which a person still has a reasonable expectation of privacy, at least arguably.
So, but presumably that would have, a minister would have to sign off
no.
on that.
If it's publicly available, no. It doesn't go through any of this regime that we've been talking about.
Okay.
It's excluded from the external checks and balances. So it seems to me that you have to have a certainty about what publicly available is to ensure that the information you're most concerned about gets steered into the checks and balances. So my proposition is simply to say publicly available does not include information in which a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Is that not there?
No, there's no definition
whatsoever.
So that
would be a good addition.
I think so, because I don't think anything in which a person has reasonable expectation of privacy should ever be going through the publicly available database.
Right.
Because if Section 8 goes the way I think it is, I don't think you're going to be able to defend that use, and you're setting up a legacy of ashes in the future. So I don't think that's that complicated. I don't think it's that detrimental to the operational effectiveness of the service. The CSIS has gone in front of Parliament and said, we're not going to include hacked information in publicly available. So that's on the record, although it's not in the law. And as we know, things said in Parliament sometimes are forgotten with the passage of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important to embed these concepts in the law. Again, not for the most virtuous of security services, but for the most inept. That's how you build your law, with checks and balances. And I think that would be a simple fix. And so far, I haven't heard anything to persuade me otherwise.
Maybe there's a data set of just your recommendations that are being ignored, Craig. Okay, well, I mean, this is another long-ish podcast.
I get kind of excited about this stuff.
No, I mean, but look, this is really important. This is going to be the future of investigations for our country for the next God knows how many years, because this is the largest change to our national security architecture since 1984. Yeah. And that is huge. And it really doesn't get a lot of attention. And I think we are fixing a lot of the problems of C51, but if we don't engage in this that often, let's get it right the first time.
Well, you got to anticipate the trains coming down the tracks, right? So it's not ODAC 10 years from now with another decision of the federal court saying, oh, you know those things you've been doing? You
all
don't actually
legal.
Have statutory authority.
Yeah. Which, again, look, certainty is good and certainty is useful. And I'm certain we've gone on for far too long.
Okay. Thanks very much, everyone. And I think we're probably going to be off for a week and then back by mid-November.
Yes, that's the plan. I got to travel. But who knows? There's going to be a lot that may come out between now and then. So we'll see you then.
Until next time.